and welcome to Genetics Unzipped, the Genetics Society podcast with me, Dr. Sally LePage. In this episode, I'm chatting with Professor Jim Koster, learning about one of the less known, but by no means less accomplished, founding fathers of biology, Alfred Russel Wallace. Nothing in biology makes sense except in the light of evolution. So said the geneticist Theodosius Dobzhansky, and as a former evolutionary biologist, I'd have to agree. The discovery of natural selection, that is, the non-random differences in reproductive success between individuals as the driving force behind evolution, adaptation, and the origin of species, was one of the most important discoveries in the history of science. So important, it was discovered twice. Yes, you heard that right. Natural selection was discovered twice by two separate people independently of each other. One is, of course, the famous Charles Darwin, who more than deserves his place as the most famous biologist of all time. But the other, Alfred Russel Wallace, is often resigned to a footnote, an addendum to Darwin's story, the man who spurred Darwin into writing his ideas down in The Origin of Species. But today we're flipping the switch and telling Wallace's story. So to do that, I sat down with Professor Jim Koster, an evolutionary biologist and entomologist at Western Carolina University, who recently published a book called Radical by Nature: The Revolutionary Life of Alfred Russel Wallace. And as it's a very good place to start, I decided to start at the very beginning. Who was Alfred Russel Wallace?
Alfred Russel Wallace was something of a almost polymathic Victorian era naturalist, and maybe most famous as the co-discoverer with Darwin of the principle of natural selection in 1858, but also recognized today as the founder of what we would call modern evolutionary biogeography, the study of the geographical distribution of animals and understanding that distribution of species on Earth today is really a product of a combination of evolutionary processes, but also geological history and climatic history. And Wallace was one of those in the 19th century that was able to really see with great clarity these patterns and put this all together.
Now, we know that a lot of Darwin's ideas were solidified through the Voyage of the Beagle, Galapagos Islands, very famous. And it seems Wallace had almost a parallel path to the exact same ideas. Can you tell us a bit about that? Because I think that's such a huge part of his story, is the traveling and collecting that he did.
Yeah, certainly. I do see some really striking parallels in the intellectual trajectories, you know, between Darwin and Wallace, in that both of them, they're of a time of exploration, discovery, you know, collection of natural history specimens was an important part of the scientific pursuit in the day. And both of them were part of that enterprise. But Wallace specifically, in reading Darwin, right, Voyage of the Beagle as a young guy, but also other natural history treatises like that of Charles Lyell, the geologist, reading Alexander von Humboldt, you know, he had this interest, this keen interest in travel. But in his case, from the get-go, his interest in travel seemed to be motivated by a very particular interest in understanding the nature of species and varieties, and maybe helping to investigate what was considered a great mystery of the time, which is the nature of the origin of species, perhaps something of a heretical notion, you know, for some. This is something that Darwin came to after his voyage around the world on HMS Beagle. But Wallace seemed to be interested in traveling specifically with this in mind. And he found a way with a friend, a kindred spirit, Henry Walter Bates, to travel and collect, and with the help of a very capable agent back in London, finance their travels by sending specimens back to London, and these would be offered for sale to the growing museums of the time, wealthy collectors that were interested in exotic and rare species. And so they're essentially financing their travels and explorations in that way. And all the while, though, they're holding back duplicate specimens for later study. And he travels for 4 years in South America. And then shortly thereafter, he travels another 8 years in Southeast Asia, modern day Indonesia primarily. And it is there that he makes some of his greatest discoveries in terms of geographical distribution of species and discovers the principle of natural selection. And so, in fact, achieved this amazing goal of helping shed light on what some eminent philosophers of the day call the mystery of mysteries, you know, the question of the origin of species. So Darwin and Wallace are interesting in that they're sort of parallel in their intellectual trajectories, but Darwin comes to his evolutionary insights after his travels, whereas Wallace is motivated to travel precisely to investigate this. So there's a kind of inversion in a way of how they approach this multifaceted question of the nature of species and varieties independently until their paths converged very dramatically in 1858.
Yeah, and very famously, if people have heard of Wallace at all, it's probably Darwin receives a letter from this plucky up-and-coming naturalist saying, hey, I've got this idea. And Darwin goes, oh, shoot, better write mine all down in a book. I think it's really interesting because thinking obviously from an evolution perspective, you think about convergent evolution and two adaptations evolve independently and separately, partly because both species are in the same sort of environment. So it's almost inevitable that they'll come to the same solution to solving this problem. And you've got these two people in this time period, both solving, as you put it, the mystery of mysteries. Like, this was a tricky problem that no one had solved up until the 19th century. And yet within one lifetime, you've got two dudes from England, or Wales, depending on how you want to call Wallace. You've got two dudes from the British Isles coming up with the same answer. Like, were Darwin not to have been born, were Wallace not to have been born, do you think it was just inevitable that someone would have come up with this theory in this time period?
Yeah, so that's a good question. And I think it's fair to say that, as with so many great scientific insights, yeah, I mean, this would have been discovered, you know, if not by them, by someone else. And of course, others have certainly pointed out that there were others, contemporaries of Darwin and Wallace, who had themselves articulated processes that essentially are very much natural selection. They didn't necessarily see the big picture. They didn't run with that ball. They didn't connect dots or publish papers or books specifically drawing attention to this idea and its potential for explaining so much. But nonetheless, you know, the idea in some measure was out there. Maybe most conspicuously, you know, Patrick Matthew comes to mind as one individual who clearly did articulate this process that we call natural selection. Maybe the idea was of the time, you know, thinking about population pressure, thinking about the role of differential survival, reproduction, competition, those sorts of things. There's almost a kind of mechanistic aspect to that thinking that one might say, and of course, this is not original with me, but it has been pointed out, can be seen as very much of the mindset of the industrial age, the industrial revolution. And so pieces of this idea of the mechanism of natural selection were out there and very much being discussed in various contexts. It's easy to imagine that had it not been for Darwin or Wallace, that someone else would have connected those dots and seen the significance for the broader philosophical questions about the nature of species, the history of species, and their relationship over Earth history. I think that probably almost certainly would have happened.
Wallace is more than just natural selection and this idea. He's also got aposematism, so bright warning colors in animals. And he also starts to go into the biogeographical regions of the world, which helps with plate tectonic theory. He seems to be quite interested in what we would now call environmentalism as well. What do you think is kind of Wallace's most important contribution to the world?
Oh, boy. Yeah, most important. Well, Certainly, and what his reputation mainly rests on, his multifaceted scientific contributions are truly monumental. I mean, even Wallace's papers, you know, several of them are just, they're widely regarded as landmark works in evolutionary biology. Several of his books, for example, his Geographical Distribution of Animals, Island Life, these are considered really, again, foundational, founding documents of whole disciplines. And his expansive interests in the biological sciences, yes, there are these other really interesting contributions as well, hitting the nail on the head with respect to explaining aposematic coloration, for example, longstanding debate with Darwin over whether natural selection could lead to a kind of reinforcement of reproductive isolation and speciation, kind of reinforcement theory, which Darwin didn't really agree with, but I think modern biologists would agree with. This is very much Wallace's viewpoint. And also thinking about sexual selection, Wallace and Darwin also famously disagreed about the nature of sexual selection. Wallace went from sort of generally accepting it to maybe, you know, waffling acceptance to eventual rejection. But his view of sexual selection, when he was still thinking this could be a real thing, differed from that of Darwin's and is closer to what modern biologists would consider to be the main mechanism of female choice, for example. And that would be female choice, maybe based on indicators of various measures of vigor or health or those sorts of things, whereas Darwin's model was very much based on pure aesthetics, something that Wallace really had a hard time with. And that's interesting. It's, you know, continues to be discussed and debated today.
Do you think he understood the importance of the work that he was doing and the breakthroughs that he made?
I think that he did, at least in some measure. In his own day, his major works, such as The Geographical Distribution of Animals, which was published in 1876, or his Island Life, I think that came out in 1880, his contemporaries, they had the highest of praise for these works. I think he was truly recognized as having just genius in his ability to really synthesize as no one else could, to really see big picture patterns, to pull together seemingly disparate lines of evidence and observation, and even innovate in interesting ways. For example, the beautiful maps that he developed for the geographical distribution of animals are, you know, they're aesthetically beautiful, but they're also really quite innovative. The way that he was both statistically and graphically representing the distribution of species was hailed as quite innovative. I think that he appreciated that his friends and colleagues in the scientific community who he admired were also so admiring of him for those contributions. And I think he was aware that this was very, very important work that he was doing. There were probably other areas where it was an open debate, you know, the nature of sexual selection, maybe this phenomenon that we call reinforcement and speciation. He probably had no idea maybe how these ideas would be regarded a century hence, or whether he would be seen as one who really laid down some important first principles. When it came to the big ideas, natural selection, which to his dying day, he thought this was tremendously important, and then his contributions to biogeography, I do think he had a good sense that these were extremely important advances in science that he made a contribution to.
It's interesting you use the word genius, because one of the thoughts I often have when learning about these historical scientific figures, so you've got your Einsteins, your Newtons, your Darwins, your Wallaces, they're all lauded as geniuses. I mean, it's one of the big criticisms of the Nobel Prize right now is that science is kind of moving away from this idea of the discovery of one lone genius, and that it's more collaborative now and the problems are much bigger. And so it's very much a team process rather than the idea of a genius. Do you think there is still a role for geniuses in modern science? Or do you think that, is it in any way dangerous to be thinking of these historical figures as these kind of standalone geniuses in how it reflects our own view of current science?
Yeah. Well, two thoughts about that. So part one here, but I do think that there are some truly exceptional individuals who are incredible in their ability to really see very deeply into phenomena of nature and use the tools at hand, whether they're mathematical or empirical, to figure these things out. Really exceptional individuals. Are they geniuses? I mean, this is a relative thing. I mean, what is a genius exactly? You know, which leads me to part two of my answer. And that is, I've long believed, although, yes, there are such remarkable, truly exceptional individuals, it's probably also fair to say that the myth of the lone genius is just that. You know, probably none of them, even the much lauded geniuses among us in history, the most creative minds, truly work utterly in isolation. I mean, some certainly they're just veritable like idea factories, you know, with their insight, or creatively, you know, just astounding in what they're able to create, a Mozart perhaps. But I do think that it's mainly used the word collaborative. That's absolutely true. And even though I have used the word genius in connection with a Darwin or a Wallace, I think they would be among the first to acknowledge that they did not work in a vacuum. They did not work individually. Very much science has always been largely, you know, if not entirely, a collaborative process. And I think that you're right. There is a danger of sort of maybe elevating certain individuals to a certain status, putting them on a pedestal as if they single-handedly now created a new field or took us in a new direction, when in fact, everyone is standing on the shoulders of others. But even in their mode of work and investigation, they are often very much relying on others. Think about Darwin and the reliance he had on his shipmates on the Beagle voyage. Think about later his reliance on his extensive network of correspondents around the world, sending him specimens, making observations. Think about the assistance of his own family, you know, his kids, Emma, his wife, family, friends, lending a hand, you know, to run his curious experiments and help him collect data and sending him specimens. And very much it's a collaborative endeavor. Darwin's correspondence alone is testament to that. You look at that amazingly voluminous correspondence. Look at Wallace, same thing. Wallace, unlike Darwin, did travel maybe more on the rough, right? But he's living among locals. He's hiring a team to work with him. He had very trusted assistants, like his assistant Ali in the Malay Archipelago, and very much relying on them. And then as he's thinking about these big questions, he's reading the literature. He's reading the work of others and making sense of that. His very livelihood and his ability to travel to investigate the big questions is made possible by a network, the network of collectors and museums and others back home. His ability to travel, let's say, especially perhaps in the Malay Archipelago, is very much context dependent upon a very extensive colonial network of mail boats and trade ships and those sorts of things. And so it's important to recognize, I think, that these personalities are not working alone, certainly. And at the same time, I might incidentally add, it's certainly important to acknowledge the colonial context of their work in the 19th century, something that they would certainly acknowledge as well.
You're listening to Genetics Unzipped, the Genetic Society podcast. You can find out more information about this episode on our website, geneticsunzipped.com, or come and say hello to us over on Twitter, while Twitter still exists, at Genetics Unzip. Here's what's coming up at the Genetics Society. If you're an undergraduate, postgraduate, or postdoc, you can apply for up to £1,000 of funding to help with the costs of attending a genetics conference. The deadline for the next round of Junior Scientist Conference grants is the 1st of October, and you can find out how to apply on the Society's website, genetics.org.uk, or of course, there's a link in our show notes at geneticsunzipped.com. Now, back to Jim Costa, as we discuss the life of Alfred Russel Wallace. you can't mention Wallace without mentioning Darwin. And it's time to ask the elephant in the room question. I mean, the fact that we started a genetics podcast and I asked you, who is Alfred Russel Wallace? You cannot imagine a world in which I would have to ask someone, who is Charles Darwin? And they both had extraordinary contributions, very similar contributions. Why do you think that Wallace hasn't been such a mainstay in popular culture? Or why isn't he as well known as Darwin?
Yeah, I've thought a great deal about that myself over the years. And I do think that the answer is multifaceted. I think that certainly the most famous of discoveries for the two of them certainly had to be the mechanism of evolution. They knew this as transmutation. We call it evolution today, natural selection. And Darwin certainly was there first, right? And Darwin had thought about this very deeply for about 20 years before he received this kind of bombshell of a letter from Wallace announcing Wallace's own independent discovery. And about 18 months after the monumental reading of their respective writings on the subject at the Linnaean Society on July 1st, 1858, Darwin, he was under pressure to really come out already with his ideas, in essence, sort of demonstrate he had been working on this. On the Origin of Species is published in November of 1859. This is rightly recognized as an absolutely landmark work in the history of science, if not the history of humanity, really, in terms of our understanding of the nature of the world and our place in it. And it's a book that Darwin rightly is very, you know, this is his baby, like this is his thing he'd been working on. Wallace, for his part, also recognizes the brilliance. For Wallace, who's a very generous spirit, he sees that Darwin has been working on this. And he actually claims that he himself, Wallace himself, could not have sort of propounded this idea nearly as eloquently as Darwin, because after all, Darwin had been pulling together evidence for this for some 20 years. So he had the highest of praise for that book. That then started maybe practically a lifetime of deferring to Darwin. Darwin himself, in private letters to Wallace, would often say, oh, you know, you share credit too. But really in public, it was really kind of all about Darwin, you know, and I get that. It's understandable. But this kind of set up a dynamic that reinforced something that is true about the both of them. And that is that at this time, it's fair to say that the Darwin name is already a famous name, right? Darwin's paternal grandfather, Erasmus Darwin, in the late 18th century, was already quite famous. He was a famous best-selling poet. He was a very well-known physician. The Darwin name was out there in 1839, but then in the second edition of 1845, A Voyage of the Beagle is published. It was originally called Darwin's Journal and Remarks of the Voyage. But, you know, this was quite a bestseller, especially the 1845 edition. So we can say that Wallace is essentially a nobody. Darwin is already quite famous. And then this discovery, maybe the most famous of famous discoveries, further just launches that name. Wallace's bump is sort of attached in a way. He's almost like on Darwin's coattails at that point, because Darwin's fame is already very much out there. So there's the dynamic. I think that you have a situation where Darwin is already a known, very well-regarded naturalist, becomes even more famous. And combine that with Wallace's tendency to constantly defer to Darwin in terms of priority for this really epic-making idea. And then finally add one more kind of piece to this little puzzle of sealing Wallace's fate in a way as always a kind of secondary light to Darwin's would be that in the eyes of scientists, right, his contemporaries, but even into the 20th century, Wallace's broad interests in social issues and especially what they consider to be nonsensical movements like spiritualism, which led Wallace, by the way, to sort of break with Darwin over the question of human evolution. I mean, this is a big deal, right?
Yeah, he seems to go back on his own views.
He seems to, yeah, yeah.
It's like he says, oh, isn't it amazing? Humans are another animal species. We've evolved.
Yes.
And then he becomes much more spiritual and he says, oh, no, wait, maybe our brains are a little exceptional and didn't go through the same process.
Yes, yes. And you can imagine that did not sit well, right, with Darwin and his circle. That was probably the single biggest issue that strained the relationship of Darwin and Wallace, although, you know, never broke their friendship completely. But that absolutely plays a role in then undermining his reputation among naturalists in his day and then carrying forward into ours.
Your book, Radical by Nature, this is the fourth book you've written about Alfred Russel Wallace. What makes you keep coming back to Wallace time and time again? Is it his ideas, his personality? What is it that you just can't get enough of?
Yeah, Wallace, he truly is just, he's endlessly fascinating. Again, as I mentioned earlier, you know, the magnitude of his scientific contributions, where he came from, what he did to make those achievements, that in itself makes him quite remarkable, right? Coming from growing up in sort of a life of relative poverty, leaving school very early on, so his formal education ends in his mid-teens, really being an autodidact, a self-taught naturalist who has the audacity to think that he could investigate grand philosophical scientific questions and doing it, you know, against all odds. Like, how in the world would someone with his lack of means, lack of money, lack of formal education, lack of social connections, lack of institutional support of any great museum or university manage to do what he did? I mean, that in itself, wow, you know, he's truly remarkable. But then you sort of think about his extensive interests in these social issues, his deeply generous response to Darwin, and the realization that Darwin had gotten there first with this great discovery, but then these other interests with respect to social justice. I just think, you know, he is a singular personality in all of the history of science. I just can't think of a more multifaceted, fascinating, admirable individual. And so I think that partly as an educator, I mean, I teach evolutionary biology, I teach history of evolutionary thinking, I teach biogeography. I became keenly interested in teaching Wallace, of course, along those lines. And I became dissatisfied with narratives I sometimes came across where these are pro-Wallace narratives out there where some seem to feel that to elevate Wallace's profile, we must tear down Darwin. And there's all sorts of, over the years, you know, books and papers and all these suggestions that Darwin was dishonest, that he ripped Wallace off, that he suppressed Wallace, that he did this. And of course, I would like to know if that's true. I delved into that documentary literature myself. I mean, I'm keenly interested. Is that true? You know, the conclusion I came to is that no, there's not a shred of evidence for that. And I became rather dissatisfied that among some of my fellow Wallace fans, there were some that seemed to feel like we have to undermine Darwin to honor Wallace. I've also written about Darwin and his intellectual trajectory, and I find him utterly fascinating as well. And I make the case that these are both remarkable individuals that we need to honor as our, maybe jointly as our kind of first guides, let's say, to these evolutionary insights. And so I think part of the reason I keep coming back to Wallace, I want to elevate him for my fellow scientists, audience of scientists, my students and my colleagues, but also the broader reading public interested in intellectual history. We need to do better by Wallace. And I'd like to also help correct the record. I feared that this narrative of a dishonest Darwin doing Wallace wrong kind of thing was really doing a disservice to everybody, certainly. It doesn't help Wallace any, and it's just dishonest. It doesn't really help the cause of understanding the history of ideas. And so that's partly my motivation as well. I guess it's always the educator in me wanting to share my insights in these various ways. And so that's what keeps me coming back, you know, to Wallace and also to Darwin.
That's all for now. Thanks to Professor Jim Costa from Western Carolina University, and his book, Radical by Nature, is available from your book retailer of choice. We'll be back next time with a bonus episode. It's like Christmas already. All about the genetics of type 2 diabetes, made with the Society for Endocrinology. For more information about this podcast, including show notes, transcripts, links, references, and everything else, head over to geneticsunzipped.com. You can find us for now on Twitter at geneticsunzip. And please do take a moment to leave us a rating in the Spotify app or review us on Apple Podcasts. It really makes a difference and it helps more people discover the show. This episode of Genetics Unzipped was written, presented, and produced by me, Sally LePage. It's a first Create the Media production for the Genetics Society, one of the oldest learned societies dedicated to promoting research, training, teaching, and public engagement in all areas of genetics. You can find out more and apply to join at genetics.org.uk. The executive producer is Kat Arney. Our theme music was composed by Dan Pollard. The logo was designed by James Mayle, and audio production was by Emma Werner. Thanks for listening, and until next time, goodbye.